beginning pre-World War II and into World War II, serious gaming became a real institution in the military. And, really, in the last 5 decades, we've been using gaming of all sorts to teach medicine, medical procedures, anything that really involves interaction and simulation for very specified discrete learning goals. And these are skills, but also cognitive efforts such as problem solving, teaming, learning how to understand ambiguous situations and deal with conditions of uncertainty. So those are all things that simulation and gaming really help, in addition to providing safe ways to deal with, even back in the old chemistry classroom simulations, we wanted to make sure that we weren't blowing kids up, or at least... You may have wanted to blow them up, but you didn't want them to really have that experience in your classroom. So, simulations and gaming have been a natural kind of extension of what I've been doing. Dr. Swan, in our different collaborations, he is really an expert at developing online game boards and formats and ways to interact that have really been. It's been a very energizing collaboration for me. So one thing that we decided to do was have a teacher academy after my digital game-based learning P20 lab got funded. And I say funded with a small F. It's not a huge grant.
It's actually a subscript F.
somebody.
Here, I'll grab it. Yeah.
We have somebody attending via Skype who signed up for the colloquium. So what we want to describe from this digital game-based learning lab, one of my first tasks was to have a teacher academy in the summer and invite teachers from the Central Kentucky Cooperative Schools, which are the 19 contiguous counties in and around Fayette. And so we had, 15 teachers at this academy, and it was digital game-based learning and instruction. So we did using and choosing games. But we also wanted to show them sort of a formulation of an extrapolation of gaming into instructional context that's called the play test. And so what we thought we'd talk to you about today, because we're just starting to gather data, but since Dr. Anglin asked me if I had anything interesting, I always think I like to kind of pick the collaborative brain of the MIC colloquium attendees. So. We're going to talk to you about this little case study that we started. This was accepted at AECT this year as a hot topic paper or something like that. But as it turns out, I couldn't go and Jerry couldn't go, so we didn't go to AECT. We canceled, but we'll just sort of present some of the things that we would have presented there. But of course, I didn't totally finish it because I didn't need to go to AECT. Not that this is a low... The first thing we thought we would do today is just describe the playtest, what it is, and the playtest we used this summer that Jerry developed as a Web 2.0 interactive Google game board, and describe a playtest per se. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the playtest that we had our teachers do, how we debriefed them, and then comments that they made about using this instructional strategy. And then I want to finish up with something a little off point, but not quite, and that is last Saturday and for the next 4 Saturdays, I was asked, we all were asked, Jerry, the digital P20 lab, which is sort of the royal we, Jerry and I, we were asked to by three participants at the academy to come and do an enrichment program at Danville. Independent schools, and this is for 3rd, 4th, and 5th graders, and we're teaching them me and Scott Walker down there. We're teaching them Scratch programming, and we're teaching them how to use and choose some games, and they're going to be instructors in their class next semester with some games they picked out for STEM content. I don't know how this will all work out, but I did want to just show you, we gave them a pretest for how they've been using games, and so I just want to show you this, 77 kids, and there's actually 82 signed up for this, quite a few kids that we'll be able to follow for 3 years, because apparently these kids go to this after-school enrichment, or some, 5-week enrichment program year in year. It's a lot of fun. These are disadvantaged kids, mostly, except I found out after I taught all day, last Saturday that three of the kids in my first class were school board members' children. So I'm like totally glad nobody mentioned that. I've been freaked out, but they are. So I don't know. I feel like they were kind of plants. All the disadvantaged kids and the school board members. But, so Jerry's going to introduce you to the notion of a playtest, what it is, how we're, you know, operationalizing it, and then we'll take a look at the data collection that we did with these teachers, and then we'll talk just a little bit about their comments. And it was, you know, it was a one-day thing. We did it on one day in the academy. So, Jerry, playtest.
Well, as we were kind of thinking of this, and we said, okay, well, at the end of the day, we still have to learn something out of this, right? That's the primary objective, is not just to have them play something, but to actually have them play something that they can get something out of. And so in sort of designing the playtest, I was really thinking about, well, what are elements that are common in the most enduring games? And I think the first one is simple transactions. Right? If you play, think of most games you play, cards, checkers, Connect Four, whatever. Each move is very, you know, you flip a card, you do something. It's not actually a whole lot of effort to engage in a transaction. It's very, very low threshold transactions. It's the accumulation of transactions that makes the game complex. Right? It's when you play lots of different rounds of cards and things, it's that accumulation of all those little events that actually comes into something that's very sort of robust and fun. So I wanted to take the idea of saying, okay, so what are we going to do with our playtest to start with that idea? So the content that I sort of picked to do this around was heat transfer. So it's in the core content, it's in physics, it's in chemistry. In terms of how it applies to people's everyday life, what are your two biggest utility bills? Or where do most of your utility bills go towards? Heating and cooling, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Heating water and heating and cooling the air. So that's where we spend a lot of money on trying to move heat from one place to the other. We're either trying to move it from inside to outside or outside to inside. And so that was sort of the content that kind of started off. So I said, well, what's a simple transaction we can do? And then so I'll pass these around here. But these are just infrared thermometers. You point them at something, you press a little button, it tells you what's the temperature of it. Pretty simple to do. And so the play test was called Hot Spots and Cool Places in Downtown Lexington. We gave them some challenges. And we said, well, we want you to go out and find the hottest non-building surface, and the coolest non-building surface, and the hottest building temperature. And so we gave them, you know, the hottest color you could find, and all of these different things. And we just set them out and turned them loose. And they really just had a blast. You just walk around, and you guys can see, you just start pointing at stuff. And so we've got lots of pictures of them just kind of walking around downtown, you know, looking a little crazy, because they're, you know, they're just in groups just doing this. But what they're doing in terms of a learning process is they are doing data collection. They're doing inquiry. They're making observations. They're building inferences. Now, all of this is happening on a very tacit level. We haven't even talked about ideas of conduction or convection or anything like that. But just to give you a sense of the difference between a game-type element and a typical simulation, this is a game that was built by a teacher here in Fayette County, Ryan McCreary, and you kind of try and shoot basketballs into the net over here. I'm a little slow. Must not have my flash player updated. Oh, there we go. Look at that.
A shot.
I totally did not know that was
it's your first time doing that. Right?
Well, the ball randomly sort of moves each time you shoot it. Now, there's lots of content in here, but it's suppressed. So just by doing that, you don't necessarily learn anything about linear functions or quadratic functions or projectile motion, even though it's all in there. The content is suppressed within the game. Versus
something like this, where you kind of have to move the weight on the scale here and try and get to the right one. Let's see, 8 and 10. I'm not going to bother exploring because I know that. I know the math here. Okay. Now, in this case, the content is pretty much the primary sort of focus. It's really right in your face, but it's not really a fun game. I mean, it's not a game. It's just really meant to illustrate content. And so that's the big difference between sort of the gaming piece versus what I would say a traditional sort of simulation visualization. Is the play element is more emphasized, but conversely, the content then gets suppressed. So back to the playtest idea. Is we have these folks going around doing all the things, collecting all this data, and
we had them in teams.
And we had them in teams, and you kind of see where they went. And the other important element of games is you have a game board, right? You have something that sort of puts all the players together. They interact around it. It becomes a point of interaction. So in this case, our game board was this little Google map. So we have a little form over here. We had 8 challenges. So each team, as they collect their stuff, puts in their data. What temperature did they find for what challenge, and where were they? And then a little pin gets stuck sort of on the map. And the colors indicate the sort of teams there. And so really this became our debriefing. So as we came back in and we looked at this as a group, now, we finished playing the game, we calculated the points, we gave prizes, and did all of that, but then we really used this to unpack the idea of what was happening. So when we looked at challenge one, which was, I can't remember, probably like the hottest. I would say, just show me all the data from challenge one. You know, and I would say, okay, purple group, what'd you guys find? I'd say, oh, 134, where was that? Metal trash can. And these are real temperatures. I mean, if you go out and that's, people were shocked by it. Like, wow, I can find, like, you know, 150 degrees out on the street.
Well, the backstory is, too, this was the hottest day of the year last summer that we sent them out into downtown Lexington. They were really happy about that.
Yeah, with their children and their pets inside parks, too.
So, you know, but we use this, again, so each challenge would sort of break this down. People talked about their experiences, and we unpacked them, and we sort of asked them what their observations were, but we really used that as sort of the anchor to sort of introduce the topics of conduction, convection, and radiation, and really help them work through misconceptions and ideas that they had sort of built out playing the game. Now, they were very tacit ideas. They didn't have any of the language or concepts, but then that's what we're using this to pull out of it. So it's the playtest is to engage them in the content, and then we use sort of the debrief as a way to assess where they are and then go in and really sort of build their content knowledge. And so, but they really became engaged in this, in the content. So as we were discussing it, they really were connecting it to what they had done. And so it was a really interesting, it was really enjoyable. They really got into it. They really liked the competitive piece of it.
Boy, did they ever.
Yeah, they really, and we incentivized it. We had, we collected all the temperature probes back, and we said the winning team gets to keep all the other team's temperature probes. So it was sort of like to the victor, go to the spoils. And they got into it. They were like, that is not a valid data point. You cannot use that. Really sort of cut to the point there. And but they really got into it, and I thought it was a really powerful example of how you can use some of these tools to pull this together. And really, it's game overlaid on top of inquiry-based instruction. So that's, again, none of this stuff is new. It's just how do we bring in these different elements to things that we traditionally do. And just to give you another example of, you don't necessarily have to have even though it's very cool to have a video game board, you don't have to have that, I did a similar thing just before we started as I came in here, and if you look back at the door there, as I took the little temperature probe and just started measuring the door and came up with a little heat scale here. So obviously that's coldest, that's hottest. And I was just kind of doing the same sort of inquiry, but just here on the door, and again creating a nice little visualization, just with little sticky notes.
Marty came in and was kind of like, what the hell's he doing? You know, but again, you could, it's sort of fun trying to find where's the hottest and coldest spots in the door, but then you could start to break down and talk about, well, look at the temperature gradient. What do we have here? We've got a draft spot. Right? It's coldest over here on the door. We've got another draft spot here. Here we've got what's called a thermal bridge. You know, so you've got all these different ideas that you can then unpack from people sort of engaging in that. So I did that, but if I had some more, we were all going to do it. But that's
yeah, we were going to have you do it, but the temperature thing just didn't really work out.
Yeah, the two that I have, they're one's 4 or 5 years older, so its calibration is way off, and so you'd end up with wildly different numbers.
Yeah, we gave all our thermometers away in the playtest for the summer. We only had two left.
And apparently we bought all of the thermometers in Radio Shack.
We don't want to get into
they don't have them anymore.
We cleaned them out
last summer.
So one of the, we wanted to get an idea of what we're talking about here for a playtest and really, give you, just an anchor so you know where we're going with this case study. And I'm only calling it a case study because right now there's nothing else to call it. It's as loose as data can possibly be. But we are trying to formulate some ideas about where we might take a look at this. I think making the case for any new tool as instruction is a lot easier for anybody who is an instructor in any context, whether it's a medical context or a K-12 context or anything. But I think that the thing that we've really lost in instruction, and those of us that have been around instructional design for a long time, or what we've lost is the connection of assessment with instruction. The real meat of formative assessments, where it's really to inform instruction. And so one of our goals in this academy was to really emphasize with the teachers using gaming sort of approaches for this assessment piece, for formative assessment as a basis. It's a good question. Is this really assessment or is this instruction? But really, we were using it from a really open-ended inquiry base to say, well, what do these people know about e-transfer? What can they tell us? What can we then go back to? What kind of experience can we give them all, to have a shared common experience that you might teach from, and that we can refer back to? I mean, this is prior knowledge. I mean, none of this stuff is new, but how would you really use gaming for that piece of, formatively beginning instruction and then moving through your instruction to understand what people really know about particular content pieces. But we did want to just give you, play tests are, they come from the old iterative design stuff where, you do a game or something and then you play the game, see if it works, if it doesn't work, you can learn it and so forth. But it's the notion of getting people up and doing something, whether you have digital data collection, so really getting them engaged and doing something that has real playful elements. Competition in the best sense of the word, rewards, fun, things that are elements of play as opposed to, as Jerry's saying, just elements of simulated experiences that might be a little more straightforward.
To build off of what John's saying, like a lot of the questions that they asked, when we went through and we'd pull up and we'd say, tell us where you got this from. They said, well, we measured this car that just pulled up, and we figured, oh, this will be the hottest temperature. And they went over and they took the hood temperature, and then they said, but it wasn't as hot as the one that had been parked there. And so we just said, well, that's because they're insulated. You wouldn't want 500 degrees of engine temperature sort of searing up and burning pedestrians. But it really gave us a chance to say, well, what is the rationale behind the choices that they're making? And then it was really a good way to get people to not feel, it's amazing in sort of teacher PD, anytime you threaten to do an assessment with them, you can see everybody just kind of, they run to the corner and they hide and say, oh no, that sounds horrible, but really getting to the sense of, well no, this isn't horrible, we're just trying to, we're trying to figure out what we need to work on.
When you talk about the quantity evaluation, are you thinking about it from the perspective of during the instruction and process, or are you thinking about it from the designing sort of the system perspective?
Well, I think you can think of it either way. We were talking about it more from the instructional processing because we're trying to get teachers have come to this academy to learn how to use gaming in sort of the instructional process, which kind of drives me crazy, even in our teacher preparation programs, but we kind of forget that instructional design is like what people are supposed to be doing. So I think teachers don't really have a good sense of how to use formative dimensions of anything, evaluation. But we also could use this as a formative piece of the design cycle, for example, on the game board. Now, this is a location-based game board, and it obviously works pretty well because it's a Google map, but, you know, we might have some other... Although, I will tell you that we used this same playtest with Becky McNall's. She invited us to come and talk to the elementary technology blockers. I don't know, studio model, whatever they do in that exactly, but you know, whatever their sequence is. But when we did it, we used Scott Street, and because we only had an hour, really, we didn't really have time for them to fan out. And the problem with Scott Street, though, is that the addresses are really wacky. I mean, the
300 Scott Street is here. 301 is here.
Right.
306 is there, and so, you know, just sort of...
Well, it was really difficult to have...
Not Taylor.
Yeah, well, then there was the whole College of Ed, and like on Google, like right where the breezeway is, it was what, 306 or 316 or something. So the firehouse was 300. Martinez, this stone place here, you know, when you pull out of the driveway, was 301, you know, with that whole parking lot between them. So it really was a wacky thing. So the location-based things can still have difficulties, you know, I mean.
I was wondering, when you did the original piece with the academy, did you talk about maybe using GPS coordinates and mobile devices? Or I didn't know if that
we
was...
We just didn't have time to do it.
Yeah.
They could have easily, just even with their smartphone,
right,
they could have just gotten on the web and put in the form.
Gotcha.
You know, I mean, we just didn't have time to do that, and we didn't have time to make sure they brought their smartphones with them. But that would have been nothing to do.
Yeah.
Do you think that would have
added? Do you think it would have added anything, or just more?
I think what it would have gotten away from was sort of the little clunky piece after they've been out and all the stuff. They had to come back and enter the data. So I think it would have been more fun like that to just be roaming around. Now it's a good question how it would have affected the game
socially.
If they could see where other people were going.
If someone found a real hot spot and if everyone started tracking to.
Now we were involved in a playtest. We went to a workshop that this guy Greg Niemeyer from Berkeley did, and we did a playtest in downtown Lexington. And he had us just running all over hell, looking for clues, and we didn't know what we were looking for, and we were trying to put a story together, and it turned out it was some piece of wood or something that was in that piano, or I mean, we were... We were running all around, but they had a cell phone server, so we knew where people were going, and when people found clues, and you saw the other team had found this bunch of clues... You could just see people running and things, all these teams are. So the social dimension would definitely be added. And
socially,
I think it would. Yeah. That's what all these multi-user games are doing. But we had very narrow goals, I would say.
You know, about the formative in the instruction and sort of informing sort of the overall design process, I think it's both, because in order to be able to do that sort of on the fly in the process stuff, it really, I think it really has to be well structured, you know, how it's all coming together so that you can actually use it on the fly. So it was trying to also getting a sense of, can someone actually use this on the fly to inform their decisions, as well as, you know, actually doing it in play. So it was sort of a both, trying to feel out, okay, well, what are the mechanisms that you need to allow someone to kind of do that, and what's the experience level they need to have in order to sort of process the feedback and run the class at the same time.
It doesn't preclude, I mean, obviously, I mean, you have, the teacher will have to have some really, just like all inquiry, you know, have some really tuned up content knowledge, you know, to be able to handle, you know, a question like, well, why is the blue car hotter than the black car? You know, why, you know, what, is it in the shade? Is it? I mean, you know, to really do a good debriefing for this. But I was sitting in the back taking notes and just kind of observing all this. And I was thinking, you know, this is a group of elementary teachers, quite a few math teachers, not many science teachers, but quite a few math teachers. And you know, they really had really interesting observations, but they did need help in putting it together. And I'll tell you about that in a second when we got this color thing, because Jerry, fortunately, is a physics teacher, so you know he was able to kind of move us even into the discussion of the spectrum and colors and so forth. And you know, you just none of this precludes really good content knowledge. You know, that's always the important piece of that. So you know, this is what I've mentioned before. You know, I mean, more and more, you know, there's all this innovation talk, which just kind of makes me want to vomit, frankly, because people are saying these new things like constructivist teaching, anchored instruction, anchored this 21st century skills. I call them 19th century skills. I think Edison was probably a good problem solver. But,
and also, the first time anchored instruction was written about wasn't yesterday.
No, I think it was 1989, I believe, you know. So, yes. But we're trying to develop the notion of really, really getting people more into assessment and inquiry, you know, just more on the end of active learning that really involves data collection and things that really require people to think about what they're doing more than just didactic instruction. Yeah, let's see. Now, that's interesting. But I just want to give you a little bit of some of the conceptual framework. This isn't the conceptual framework. I don't know why that's out of order, because I was mostly doing this about 20 minutes before we started. So I was trying to port some things over from the AECT thing. But kids do spend an awful lot of time gaming, using media. And here, let's see, did I miss this? Oh, I did miss something here. I'm sorry, I missed this, but there's a slide before this that should be there that says that kids spend about 7.5 hours a week using various kinds of gaming media. And out at USC, they've developed a really interesting metric, because they say because they're media multitasking, these 7.5 hours actually packs 10 hours and 45 minutes worth of media content. So, you know, it's not just that they're, you know, they're not just looking at their Wii game. You know, they've got a video running in it or a video game. You know, that there's much more media packed into that. And it's a really interesting metric, because I'm sort of horrified that they spend just 7.5 hours. But if it can qualitatively be the equivalent of almost 11 hours, you know, that they're just really spending a lot of actual and cognitive time in these environments. And one thing I'm really trying to emphasize is that kids don't learn with games because they're fun and entertaining, although they are. These dimensions of active learning, interactivity, feedback and assessment, engaging them in inquiry, I mean, these are actual learning dimensions of learning and feedback that have been around for many, many years. More than proven instructional strategies. And I just want to mention these creativity, decision-making, self-direction, problem-solving. These are the things they're talking about in 21st century skills that are incorporated into gaming. Just giving you a little bit of this background. And now I'm going to switch to my other presentation, because I didn't have time to do it. How bad is that? Terrible. I don't know if you can see it. There are a couple principles of game-based learning that I just want to mention to you. This biological imperative of play, that it's naturally employed as an effective learning paradigm, so to speak. It sounds very, I mean, to play is human. We, you know, kids play naturally. We don't have to, all of us play naturally. And so this is referred to in some of the literature as this biological imperative. You know, people need to inquire and have fun doing it. It requires interaction and participation. There's a pretty much constant cycle of action and reaction that leads to engagement. And these are, you know, things that we've heard over and over again regarding effective modes of learning. Problem-based learning, according to our friend Gagne, who's now, the citation is 2005, but I believe I read that when I was a teacher education in 1971 with the 9 events of instruction. I'm not kidding you. That problem solving is the highest level of learning.
and that it's a vehicle for intellectual skills and promotes transfer. Delisle stuff is really interesting because there is some good control. There are two good control studies that seem to show that game use, and this was done in the military context. So these are serious games, you know. So there's high stakes outcomes, but that it really does promote transfer, which I think is really interesting because, you know, transfer is just difficult. It's very difficult to have transfer in a lot of learning situations. Jonathan and others have noted that two critical attributes of any problem, the unknown and the ambiguity, requires the generation of new knowledge. I mean, you have to try and be generative about your solutions. And that there's value to the learner in solving the problem. There's feedback, and there's also some evidence that self-efficacy is really improved because people accomplish things. That's one of the things we're looking at with these third, fourth, and fifth graders. I'm really kind of interested in being able to get a program to work like Scratch, really able to get their sprites and things to actually accomplish the goal. You know, if it really makes them feel like they're in control of being able to make a decision, figure out a solution, and, you know, if that actually makes them feel more confident in problem solving. Because I think, you know, like Jerry was saying, look, I'm taking the Spanish 101 class, and I just fall apart every night. We have a test, and, you know. So, I mean, I think it's difficult. This is a great learning experience for me. I never had a minute of test anxiety in my life, and now I can hardly go to class on test nights. But problem-based learning requires short and long-term goal setting, has been positively correlated with learning without Bandura, and games are almost entirely problem-solving. I mean, that's even in the simplest maze games, you know, you're trying to figure out how to get to the end. The whole literature, as Gary is saying, this stuff, Brown, Collins, and McGee, you know, their work in 1989, situated cognition and the culture of instruction, anchored instruction. These are not new ideas. But gaming, because it is a contextual activity that involves the user in some sort of a role in the game where they act on the game features and get feedback, situates them in any particular situation. And some game genres, which I'm not going to go into here, but there are several game genres that are quite different. And Jerry was kind of alluding to them. He was showing the difference between the basketball shooting thing in a simulation where you have, you know, a problem-solving game or an adventure game that's really a story, or you have a puzzle game. I mean, there are different game genres that really, you know, operate differently in all these contexts. But it is interesting to think about how gaming is just a new flavor or a new package for things that we know about teaching and learning and instruction. Well, this is obvious, I guess. Yes, I'm getting out of that. I'm back to what I was saying. I just didn't have time to transfer all that over. Sorry about that. So here's what we did. And you know, I think if Yin or Bob Steak heard me call this an exploratory state case study, I think they would, like, usher me out of the room. I mean, this is a pre-exploration of a case study. But we wanted to kind of show you some of this stuff because I think it's kind of interesting. We have to engage teachers in using these new technologies. We have to make them feel comfortable playtesting, you know, and things like that. But this is, you know, what Jerry just told you, this is what we did. And Jerry was doing the heavy lifting of the debriefing, and I was observing. And we have interviewed them now that they're back in their classrooms. Three of these folks, like I said, are people I'm working with at Danville. This is what was really interesting. They were surprised at how much content we were able to cover using that game. And they came back. One of the things that Jerry did was really articulate all the various science concepts and core content kind of things that we were going through. And they were just really surprised at how much we covered. And this was an afternoon. Like, we sent them out because we had very limited time in this academy. We told them they had to do the play test and combine it with their lunch hour. So they had about, 2 hours to go out. And it was okay because one of the challenges was some indoor heating context. So we had them, you know, hottest inside wall, coolest inside wall, so they could do some of their data collection wherever they were eating lunch too. But that was about all that we were able to give them. And they could, I asked them, and we asked them as we were talking, if they could think about using this kind of an application for both formative and possible summative assessment applications. And it was really interesting to have them think about how they would really use this as a summative, an actual final exam of some sort for heat transfer. I mean, would they be willing to trust those, that they really covered that content? How would they do that? And a couple of them emailed me the 2 or 3 days later and said, you know, I've been thinking about that play test, and I think what I would do is I would anchor the instruction, like the assessment. I would give them, you know, a screen capture of a portion of the game board with some of the call outs that have the data set in them, and ask them to either select from some multiple choice or write about what that was as a summative assessment. And I thought that was pretty good thinking. So, you know, we're trying to push them to simply use this, because the kids are really engaged in the content. You know, that's one of the pluses of this. One of my kind of insights that I'm just playing with is it's a more prospective approach to instruction and assessment than retrospective. You know, it's not didactic. You teach something and then you ask people to recall or extrapolate or transfer what they're doing. You know, it starts out more from what can you tell us about what you learned from this experience and move it forward. And it's a slightly different strategy. And believe me, these are such nascent insights. I hate to even, it's not even called an insight. You know, an almost sight at the moment. But we were really able to anchor this assessment debriefing in that game. That's one thing we think really did work. So
this really shakes up the idea that if you have a science classroom in a lab, which you could actually have, you know, the digital game-based learning, you really go in through a simulation in the debriefing.
Mm-hmm.
I have two students working on this science labs, this is really interesting. Instead of using technology to create simulated labs, to use digital game-based learning, that's sort of built in before, and then briefing comes later. You know, that's a completely different sequence thinking in science.
Well, but it, you know, it maps very well if you take something. I don't know how many of you heard of like the learning cycle. This is a very sort of typical way to structure inductive sort of inquiry-based learning, but they have these stages where you go explore the phenomenon, then you begin to, you start off with some engagement activity, then you explore the phenomenon, then you explain the phenomenon, and then you sort of elaborate. This is sort of getting a transfer, but it's moving from very non-abstract tacit representations to, you know, really by the time you're finishing up, that's when you're really bringing in the formula and all of this sort of thing and the formal definitions and whatnot. But what we did here maps very well with this, with the sort of you're engaging, you're exploring with the content, but then that's not enough. Then it really becomes that formalization process where you're helping people pull out what exactly is the phenomenon that they're looking at, which if you don't do that part, you know, you can have them throw footballs with buzzers around the room and, you know, they may or may not make any connection that you're talking about the Doppler effect, right? That, you know, so it's,
the what?
Yeah, right. So you then have to actually get down to the nitty-gritty of it, but that doesn't happen usually without instructor intervention.
And you know what's interesting about this, like, you know, Gary was saying, you know, everything just doesn't sound new, but this prospective approach, you know, I have my master's in philosophy, so I was what was called a process philosopher, but what was really interesting in this is that this is more in the process approach of, like, Charles Peirce and, who was the mathematician, Whitehead, and some of those early
you know, cosmologists. You know, they when you read their stuff, they sound a little nutty. But one thing that they probably were, but they have a real interesting idea. Like Whitehead says that really learning that is memorable, that helps people make sense of things. He called it RPM, romance, precision, and mastery. So gaming kind of goes in that cycle. And I when I first read that, which was a long time ago, Whitehead stuff, I thought how I learned to play the piano. You know, I mean, you know, you go up and you bang a piano, you think it's kind of cool, you know, you're kind of romanced by these things. You know, you're kind of like, oh, how neat, you know. But then you take piano lessons. Boy, was that, you know, where was the romance in that? Doing scales, and you know, you get precise. But when you then get to some level of mastery, that's when you can start to play and, you know, do a little bit of your own variations or tempos or, you know. But this romance, precision, mastery, I kind of think about gaming that way when you use it in this more prospective way, like Doug's saying, you know, we're really trying to get people engaged and interested in something and then slowly bring them into the precision and the vocabulary of a discipline or whatever, you know. And Whitehead had a really funny thing that even back then when they he was, I remember seeing the 19th century, but, you know, they were just doing motor cars and things like that, and he was saying revving up the RPMs, but it was so hokey because he was such an odd, wacky guy, you know. But I do think that this romance, precision, mastery is more the prospective way of getting at content knowledge than we're typically used to using. Now, okay, that's. I hope you don't feel like you were cheated coming all the way out for this presentation here. But I do want to show you something really interesting that is literally data hot off the presses. So we're doing this Danville, Kentucky University. It's 5 Saturdays. It's in Richmond. The 3 of the people who were in this academy this summer who did this playtest were really taken with this idea, and they actually asked us if we would come and do their whole enrichment program. They usually do math content and aesthetics and art stuff. They asked if we could help them frame the whole academy, the whole university enrichment thing. Around gaming. So we went and did a teacher PD. We did a using and choosing games, and we taught teachers how to use Scratch. And these are elementary teachers who were just apoplectic, wouldn't you say, at having to learn. I mean, they were like gripping. and we taught them Scratch because we said, we can teach you these things, but you need to figure out what you want these kids to do. And so we really used a participatory design strategy. Some of you know the work I like to do with information ecologies and some of this people, practices, systems, and values. I mean, we wanted their input on this. You know what your kids need to know, your core content. So they did some really neat things. So what we're doing right now is for 4 hours on Saturdays, 2 hours, we have 80 kids split on 2 schools. 20 kids, first 2 hours go, and they do a using, choosing games. That they have these kids picking out games for core content, and they sorted each one of the 5 days as a genre. Like they did problem solving last week. This week they're going to look for puzzle games, but, you know, math, reading, whatever. And then these kids, these third, fourth, and fifth graders, are going to pair up back in their classrooms and teach a lesson with their teachers with some of these games. And they're showing them how to do that. That's what they're doing. I'm in the other room teaching Scratch, the problem solving stuff. And if you haven't been there, it was developed by MIT, you know, the Educational Arcade folks. They're all, you know, in the lineage of Seymour Papert, you know, and all the logo stuff that was done back then. It's a great, great programming environment. It's easy to use. It's very clever.
Very robust.
Very robust. It's amazing what you can do with it. But also, it's ready to go. It's free. But they've developed a really nice social networking site where all the kids all over the world are sharing their games. You can rate the games. You can go. And what I'm trying to teach these third, fourth, and fifth graders is when you don't know how to do something, go to the Scratch site, see if you can find somebody other game to download it and copy the, you know, this whole idea of using examples. It's really been interesting. But we gave them we got our IRB, we just, 30 seconds too soon, you know. But we gave them an Excel survey, pretest. Those are the kids' names, but let me see if I can get to it. I just thought you might be. Here's their grades. Percentage that have a computer at home, you can see the question is up there. It's maybe
Control. Can you see it? So 16 of these 72 don't have computers at home. I can't believe it. Would you, if you don't, I don't know why they want to ask this question. Of course they'd take a computer. It's interesting, but apparently six of these kids, though I have to find out who they are, created some computer game by themselves. So these are third, fourth, and fifth graders. Here's how they rate themselves when using the internet for school purposes. What?
Distinguished.
I love it.
High self-esteem, that's what I see. That's what that chart tells me.
They probably
26
are.
Of them.
They probably are really good. What is this one? How often do you play a game by themselves? Let's see. Every day, twice a week, with others. Kind of interesting. Play a game on a cell phone. That's what we found at Play the Wii. I mean, we were just asking them these questions. One thing we found out in Becky's class, though, I asked them how many, so these are high school, college students. So how many play video games? How many play games? And nobody raised their hand. I was like, what? And then I said, how about games on your cell phone? They all raised their hand. I mean, yeah. They don't even think of those games as being on a computer. Yeah. It's like Wii and the cell phone and so we have to be kind of careful about how we ask questions. Where are some of the nevers? Only 5 people never play by themselves. Quite a few don't play, play with other folks. It's kind of interesting. This is interesting. I literally looked at this yesterday. We just got it. So this is all data on how they play a game you thought your teacher could use in the class. This is kind of interesting.
The numbers go way up.
Never numbers. We should have asked them, as I looked at these the other day, we should have asked them, do you think any game would ever be used in a classroom?
did some of the teachers help design these questions? Or?
Yeah, a couple of them did. This is the question I added. because I wanted some things that are kind of based in the literature about. You can't believe this SurveyMonkey thing, so I had a matrix of things, I just had to, the first class I had was all third graders, and we had everybody on both schools do it the first thing, everybody just did the survey and get it out of the way, but I thought, I really didn't, they told me, I said, are you sure they can do this SurveyMonkey thing where they have to read this, and we told them, if you don't understand a question, just raise your hand, we'll come read it to you, and they did that, there were a couple kids that would do that from time to time. But they just went through, they could really take this survey on SurveyMonkey, even the very youngest kids. So, but I haven't really analyzed all this at all, but
Is that better from the last one?
I've created an internet game for myself. That goes with the 8 people that were,
These are numbers, not percentages.
These are, numbers, raw score.
Are they schools or
I really
counts of people?
Yeah. They're just counts. They're not percentages. They're scores. They're just how many people said true or false. I mean, like I said, it's just really raw data. I just thought you might be kind of interested in some of this. And of course, hopefully, that will increase when it says they've created an internet game. After we give them this gradually, we'll have a couple of things in there. But I just thought you might find that interesting. That just. We're trying to collect data. The DKU group provides what the parents are going to be coming on the last day for the showcase, and we have consents from their parents because I really want to. We're going to do a little session for a 20-minute session for the parents to talk about how do you talk with your kids about gaming and do you play the Wii with them and kids are using all these games, but we want to kind of help them think about how to. It's not just like homework anymore. There are a whole bunch of other things you can do to kind of promote these things in school. But we're going to interview parents, and the neat thing about DKU kids is apparently they go to this year in and year out, or at least a group does. So we have some opportunity just to follow them longitudinally. And we've pulled off all the game stuff that they did last. Danville, Kentucky University. Sorry, it's the Danville Independent School has this. It's not the county school. So that's what we're doing with gaming, but we're really going to try and see if we can look at the problem solving they're doing with their gaming, you know, to see, you know, do they self-correct, you know, do they, we'll have their product each week. And of course, we're teaching them a few things. And we're teaching how to make their sprite change color or, you know, but this week, it's only week two, but what we're doing this week is we're going to show them how to move their sprite, you know, from, you know, the window to the door or some, you know, left to right, and we're going to say, this is the x-axis. We're going to introduce x-axis and y-axis. And there's two or three kids in that class, the second group that I have, that are really savvy. One has her own website she was showing me. I mean, you know. But so we'll be, you know, I'll be interested to see if anybody can get, you know, to kind of, you know, slope functions or quadratic functions where, you know, we have things. But the x, we're going to make sure they understand x and y. And I asked a couple kids last week if they knew that, and they didn't. But I said, do you use graph paper? And they said, oh, yeah, we use graph paper all the time. So maybe we'll use that as the, you know, the spot. But it's really interesting. I'm very interested to see, because I think these games involve a lot of thinking and a lot of content knowledge that is like Jerry said, it's really kind of submerged. But the X and Y stuff, I mean, to make any movement at all, you have to put these, and they can fiddle with it, they can use trial and error, but they still have to understand that whatever that Y thing is, that's going to be going this way, and I mean, X thing is going to be going this way, and the Y thing is going to be going up. And then, and so we're going to just see the extent to which we can teach them that, they get it. And I have three teachers working in the classroom with me that we had taught Scratch, and that was the big success for me last Saturday. After the sessions, the teachers came up and said, oh, I get Scratch, this is, I can help them, I understand what they're doing now. So, I mean, that feels good, that they would then be able to kind of, you know, work with the kids. So it's kind of, I think if you ask me to present more on this next year, Gary, I think I'll have a lot more substantive hard data, but I think it's just to give you some ideas of exploring this. And we have some frameworks about problem solving and also types of game play, play for uncertainty, play for, you know, there are some dimensions of why you play and how certain games cause you to play in certain modes. But game design is a different, game development is a whole different thing. So.
I thought it was interesting when you said that they didn't told you they only get the X, Y thing, but they do use graph paper.
Yeah. But it shows you, you know, it shows you, right, exactly. You know, and you know how somehow there's a disconnect there, a real disconnect, that they don't understand that they're, and so if they're using graph paper, and, you know, it's what Jerry was talking about the debriefing. That's why it's so important. You know, you've got to get back to it. It is crazy that they would be using graph paper and not know what X and Y. Now, I drove home thinking the same thing, but I thought, well, maybe they're using it for area and perimeter too. That's a possibility. That they're using graph paper really, you know, to do it, to denote that kind of a task. I mean, I'm not sure, but there's no reason. I mean, on the game thing, and a couple kids asked me that, like, why is this number moving? You know, like right on the Scratch game board. I mean, the development piece, you know, your stage there. It's showing, you know, if you're moving your mouse, that X thing is zooming in, you know, and a couple of people have noticed that already. A couple of kids are like, what's this? Why is this moving? And I was saying, one girl, it took her about 10 minutes, but she finally figured out. She said, oh, it moves when I move my mouse. Because I said, I'm not going to tell you. You figure it out. And she was going, come on. They really want you to tell them. And that's one thing I've discovered. They want you to tell them everything. So, but that's what we did in this. We're really exploring play testing and play and gaming for assessment, and using assessment in this more perspective rather than retrospective frame. So there's lots of data from these kids already, I can just tell you that. But I'm interested in, we were contacted by people at Tate's Creek High School wanting something in Second Life and social studies. So seems like they want to do that. Well, interestingly enough, apparently Ryan said that they can do it, and he also said that they got that just Ryan McQuarrie, who he's worked for, he's a graduate of our MIC program, but he's their school technology resource teacher. But he said that math teacher. He said that they got Second Life unblocked at Tate's Creek High School, and And I said, oh, so you didn't tell them about the hot porn sites they can get to? I mean, you know, and Beth Kramer from the library is working with us in that, our social media guru. But, you know, I mean, they've unblocked Facebook. I think they've really just given it to the obvious, and that is, if you can block it in school, but the kids look at all this stuff outside of schools. And I really do think, you know, teachers do still act in loco parentis. I mean, there are real issues with predation and things on the internet that have to be considered. But there is a reality check here. I mean, I always think back to when eighth grade, my junior high school on Long Island, eighth graders every year went into the Museum of Natural History in New York, and how the teachers were crazed that we were going to go to the, you know, the magazine places in Grand Central Station and get the girly magazines. Like, I mean, kids are going to look for illicit stuff no matter what they do, and you know, you kind of, there's a real world piece here on this. So we'll see. And if you, after this, if you have any thoughts or insights, you know, Jerry and I would love to hear about any questions you have or, you know, any insight. This is very nascent, but we're just starting out. And we too are being a little exploratory now. Like, I mean, even last week at this Danville Kids University thing, we have planned now the rest of the 4 weeks, or at least tried to plan, like, things we could do. But I really wanted to see what those kids would do and how far I could get with them about changing sprite colors, making them move, having them say things. I mean, how much they could really handle and do, and they could absorb quite a bit. You know, it'd be interesting to see this week what they remember, what they pick up, and they have their games to use. It'll be interesting to see who went back and worked on them some more, played with them some more. I mean, all that stuff is just kind of seeing firsthand how these kids really use it, looking at our instruction. Kids are really, really excited about it. They just didn't want to leave. They had buses, so they didn't want to leave. They didn't want to go out to snack. But, you know, I wanted them to go out to snack. I needed the break. But. So any comments or questions? Thoughts?
This is French.
Oh. Yeah, it's www.mit.scratch.mit.
No, scratch.mit.
Yeah,
S-C-R-A-T.
Great.